I'd like to call the Kent City Council Committee meeting of July 1st to order. Public hearing. Fund.
Good evening. In accordance with the Ohio Revised Code Section 5705, we're having a public hearing for the 2027 tax budget. It's available in your packet, and it's also available in the Budget and Finance Department. Any questions? That's it.
That's it.
Okay, thank
Thanks. You. Anybody from the audience want to comment on that? Okay. Yeah. All right. So, committees, community development.
Here comes Bridget to talk about the solar array project update.
Yes, actually, I am here to introduce Matt Hammer, the principal for Civil and Environmental Consultants, which is CAC, which is the consulting group that worked with us on all the information that's in your packet. So I'm going to have Matt come up right now.
All right. Thanks, Bridget. And thank you, Mayor and council members. So again, I'm with CEC, and we partnered with Bridget and a partner of ours called CEP Renewables to work on effectively a 30% design for the potential solar project at 800 Mogador Road. And I'm just going to go over the work that we did with Bridget and take questions if you have them. So hopefully this goes well. All right. So, you know, some of the main take home messages here for council and mayor is the site can produce solar. It's not a big project. Overall, if the whole site is built out, it's about 3.5 megawatts that it can produce. Incidentally, and we'll come back to this in a little bit, the wastewater treatment plant across the river uses about 1.7 for the year. So that's a potential off taker for anything that happens at the site. We'll come back to that. Currently in Ohio, the city is limited to how a project can be constructed. So I don't mean physically constructed. I mean how a project can be set up to produce power and to sell power. And we'll get into some of that, what those limitations are. The economics of the project really depend on those limitations from the state and depends on what the off-taker is willing to pay, right, for the electricity. Some other key considerations here are that future legislation within the state and federally really could materially change the outlook for a potential project. Okay, so right now, I think what you'll find is you have some limited options. Some things might come around that would change that for you, and we'll explain some of that. In the decisions for council down the road on this, you know, it really depends on what the city is looking for out of this site. If you're looking for, you know, if you're willing to do a project just because you want it to be green and you want it to offset CO2 and things like that, that's great. If you're looking for a highly economic project, that's a different driver. And so those are the considerations that you all have to make moving forward. So overall, what I want to point out here on this slide, if you all know this site, I don't know, does this have a laser? It's got a... Hey, it's next. Where's it at? Oh, I'm just gonna learn how to point.
It disappeared. Oh, there. See it up
top. Oh, yeah. But that's it's not really a screen. Okay. Well, in any case, this is the site, and in the southwest area of the site, before you get into the area that's covered by brush, that is an area where I believe there's some contaminated soils there that are capped. And the rest of the site is not encumbered by that, but that's an area that has, again, this is a brownfield site. That's where some contaminated soils have a engineered cap on it to limit exposure. Something else I want to point out overall on the site here is the location of the wastewater treatment plant across the river from the site. And you'll also note the railroad CSX in between your or this your site, which is owned by ABB, but that solar site and the river. So I just want to point that out. Some key factors also, and again, we're going to get into some of the details here. Again, to reiterate, is the interconnection, whether to the grid or to a behind the meter user, namely the wastewater treatment plant, the economics on what folks would pay, either way, what the city would get for the produced electricity, and then potential federal investment and tax credits, which there's limitations there, and we'll talk about that. Oops. Okay, so if the site is fully built out, this is, and this you have this in your packets as well. Basically, mm-hmm. We can fill the site, and that 3.5 megawatts is what could be produced if you put solar across the entire site. You can do it on the capped area as well, the contaminated soils. That's a possibility. We've worked specifically with our partners, CEP Renewables. Put solar panels on landfills and things like that. So that's a doable thing that that can be done if you want to do that. What's actually more clear on this slide, the area, the green areas, the area of the cap of the contaminated soils, and the line that goes through the middle of that is where we're not showing panels. That's a sewer easement that goes underneath that area, goes under the river and goes into actually the wastewater treatment plant. And that's a key thing I'll talk about in a second as well. Mm-hmm. So your interconnection options, really, you have one option, and that is through the Public Utilities, I think it's Regulatory Policy Act, I think this is what this stands for, 1978. If you create a site that generates electricity and you can sell it back to the grid and you sell it to the utility, you have to sell that at wholesale pricing, right? So that's 3 to 6 cents per kilowatt hour. That's not an economic thing to do. Basically, you wouldn't be, it wouldn't be a project. There was no developer that would pick that up for you and do that. Through House Bill 15, which is in place right now, this is not, this is something that exists. You can do net metering behind the meter, so you can produce power and sell it to someone behind the meter. There's a certain requirement there on the size of the user, but the wastewater treatment plant, which would be your only possible end user, would meet that. And so that's a possibility. A physical connection required for behind the meter. So you can't generate electricity and sell it to another city property currently that's not connected physically mm-hmm. to your asset. Okay, so you can't sell it to a school down the road or anything like that. Really, the only possible user there is a wastewater treatment plant. So again, just to iterate some of these things, the main need associated with that off-taker or your particular off-taker in the wastewater treatment plant, that's a possibility, is that the easements that they need to be worked out, negotiated, and the biggest issue there is potentially, and we don't know this, okay, we didn't get into this with Bridget and the team and the city, but you would need to investigate with the railroad if they would allow you to run the electricity from the electricity lines from the solar panel at the site over the wastewater treatment plant through that easement. There's mm-hmm. two potential locations. One is that easement shown going through the middle of that capped area. It's underground. That crosses the river on a currently constructed support. So we think you could probably run it through there as long as that agreement was in place with the railroad to get under the rail. There's another potential location, and there's actually a rail bridge on the south side of the property that you might also consider. But again, I think you'd have to negotiate with the railroad to do that as well. But there's two potential connection points to get over to the wastewater treatment plant. But again, I want to stress that's not a done deal. That would have mm-hmm. to be entered into and negotiated with mm-hmm. with the railroad to make sure that you have the legal ability to do that. And then you'd have to do the engineering to actually make that happen. Okay. So a couple other things, when I talked about some future legislative issues that could help the project, there's a few bills that are continually being I guess brought up at the State House, things I want you to be aware of. House Bill 303 and 231, that's called the community energy bills. So they would allow multiple participants, meaning you could sell those, you could sell the electricity to sites that aren't physically connected to your site. Okay. But these are bills that have not been passed. They've been introduced in multiple sessions of state legislature, but they're out there. You can certainly consider issuing letters of support to your state representatives, things like that. And then Senate Bill 298 for virtual net metering, again, allows aggregation across facilities. So what this means is you could sell to like Kent City Schools in multiple locations, and they don't have to be, again, physically connected. Okay, so the project cost that we came up with, and keep in mind, this is what we're calling a 30% design level accuracy that we did for this project. And I believe you have a copy of this table, right? That's in your packet. So you can look at that with detail. And if anyone has questions, you can feel free to either go through Bridget or whatever, but you can contact us and we'd be happy to talk about it in detail. But these are our estimates for constructing that full build. So that would be about $9.3 million with a range there plus or minus 30%. You can see what that is. And again, high dependence on final scope of that project. But we think that would be the cost. There's to get the, in something that I mentioned earlier, the federal investment tax credit. There is right now, two ways to get that, and that's a 30 to, I think maybe you could consider a 40% tax credit that would be available for this project, probably closer to 30. You can safe harbor the project, but construction needs to be done by the end of 2027. Okay, so to get that tax credit to pencil in and make the project more economic for the city, you would have to have this project bid out, awarded, constructed, connected, and on by the end of 2027. That's not impossible, but it's a pretty big lift. Okay, up until that point, actually within a couple of days, it's over, so it's not on these slides, but there was another way to qualify for that safe harbor project. And that was if you bought a significant amount of the project materials prior to, I believe it was this week or next week. If you had done that, then that would have been available to you as well as a safe harbor. But again, that requires a lot of lead time with design and engineering and all that. So the other option or the other thing to look about or think about in the future is that a new federal administration in 2028 could change that. It could renew that investment tax credit, and that would be available to you again, but currently it's sunsetting. So as energy prices increase, reliance on the ITC becomes less important, but particularly for small projects like this, because this is a small solar array, it is important to make them pencil out economically. But I do want to point out, when Bridget gave us records from your wastewater treatment plant, the wastewater treatment plant in particular has seen increases, I think, over 2 cents in the last couple of years. And that's pretty per kilowatt hour, and that's pretty significant. Mm-hmm. So if you can expect those increases to come forward, this is a project that may become economical faster than you might think. But again, that's all speculation. Mm-hmm. But based on the last couple of years, that may change the calculus. Mm-hmm. So this is just a slide talking about the couple of different options that you have. One is the virtual net metering. Again, there's that's a near term, or excuse me, not virtual net metering, but the behind the meter net metering. That's really one path and the only real path for you economically, but that requires the negotiation with the railroads. So that's just keep that in mind. That's one piece. The other one, the PURPA, that's again selling back to the grid. That's not going to be economical for the city. The project isn't big enough for that to sell back at wholesale prices. And then future legislation. So if things change at the State House, if community solar gets approved, if virtual net metering gets approved, again, then you have some other buyers that could buy at market rates, and that makes things different as well. So again, just iterating some of that, proceeding under current constraints. One thing that you could consider, and that we have not done, but you could consider reducing your solar design instead of building out the whole site, make it even a smaller project to more closely match with the wastewater treatment plant. Because the wastewater treatment plant would need less than the whole site could produce. So a couple things here, the cost would not decrease linearly. So there's, as you get bigger projects, you get cost of scale, right? So if it's half the solar that you need, it's not going to be half the cost to do it. So again, you have to run that analysis, but something to consider is that you probably then would not have to put any panels over the cap landfill area, which would be more expensive. So there may be some balancing act there to study that. Again, your constraints are to get that ITC, the investment tax credit. You'd have to really get it designed, bid, and constructed by the end of 2027. Again, that's, I want to stress, that's not an easy thing. It's not necessarily impossible at this point, but it's definitely not easy. And then alternatively, of course, you have this site. There's probably not tons of demand for other uses right now. Waiting and encouraging and promoting legislation to make other ways of selling the power more economic might be the path that you choose, and just waiting for a time where it's more economic to do it. So, and lastly, the limited due diligence and continued design process. If the city wants to investigate it more, really the next steps are really investigating the easements with in negotiations with the railroad to learn if it's possible to connect over to the wastewater treatment plant, and what the lift might be, and then any engineering associated with crossing the river on those existing constraints. So with that, that's the presentation. I'm happy to take any initial questions. And again, if you have future questions, if you want to go through Bridget, and we'd be happy to get more detail.
All right, so let's open it up for questions from council. Yes, Jeff.
So we're talking about crossing the sewer line. Is that the same one we're talking about doing?
Jim would have to answer that. It might connect to that, but this is basically an existing trunk line. There's an easement that goes across under the river and connects to the water. Correct. I do want to add a couple comments. It was, we've had challenges and issues even with the easement, just because, you know, it crosses a brownfield site that's owned by a private entity. It goes under a railroad, which is also a separate entity, under the river, then to the water rec facility. So,
sorry, can I jump in real quick? Can you explain, because I'm not sure everybody understands, the presentation was great, but it speaks as if we're the owner of the land, like, yep. Council needs to decide, can you describe where we're at in the partnership, who owns what?
And yes, so the property is actually owned by a company named ABB, who bought it as part of an international global land acquisition. It came in with hundreds of properties. It's been under active remediation since under a different ownership. It was looked at in 2011, but active remediation since 2013 under the current ownership structure. I have an excellent working relationship with them, but the fact is they are still working under the voluntary action plan with the EPA. So in other words, it doesn't have its no further action or its covenant not to sue. So the city would not want to buy that. Without that, all of the remediation that is still currently occurring on that site becomes the responsibility of us. So the city would have to complete remediation under the VAPMOA program with the Ohio EPA, and then at that point invest in the solar array. So this site is the gift that keeps giving. It has had off areas basically off premise where it petroleum has been into the river. So one of that can kind of leads to another aspect of it until it seems to be plateauing. So that's good. And we have not had any off-premise areas of concern in the last almost 2 years, which is also good. Knock on wood, please, someone for me on that, because it seems like every time I think we're okay, something happens. So we should be, they're thinking within the next 2 to 4 that would be done. And so then the city could look at acquisition, and then again, legislation might be in place that would allow this. But one of the issues with those areas off premise that we were required to get an easement with and basically access from the railroad just to cross the railroad and use their access road to get to the river to clean it up. One of those off area incidents probably was about an 18-month negotiation between ABB and the railroad. And that was for a temporary access to basically use their access road along the railroad. And the other one was probably a little quicker. It was a little over a year. And that was basically to cross those tracks. So I just want to put that out there. Not that it's not possible, but the railroad is a very large entity and very protective of their property. And so the negotiations even to use the existing easement that crosses their property would be something that would require outside counsel expertise in this. We'd probably be working with CEC on some aspects of cost and things like that. So it is not going to be a quick and easy turnaround. By that time, actually, it might be a different legislative landscape. One thing I can say, though, is we know roughly costs. And the reason those costs, by the way, there's that 30% differential is because the site, when the buildings were demolished, they were done privately and not the site was not fully inspected. And we know through remediation on the site that's occurring now from ABB that foundations were left. Our demolition requirements that everything is removed, foundation, everything. That did not happen. There were multiple buildings on that site. And so ABB has identified through their own remediation activities certain situations where basically they can't be under the ground mounted. They have to pass. So there's difference in variations in those costs as well. So there'd be a lot more. This is basically a start of a roadmap, but it is complicated. And there's a lot of pieces to it. So I just wanted to make sure that that was out there. And I'm willing to take questions. And I'm not saying this was time invested, that I think this is actually a very good and viable project. I just think right now the legislative tone and tenor and then some of the complications with the remediation not being completed, it might not be the exact time that we can kick it off right now.
Additional questions from council? Yes, Ben.
Yeah, a couple. And you may have just answered it, but I was wondering about why the ballast was used instead of the post and screw, and that foundation may be a partial answer, but post and screw tends to be a lot cheaper. I'm seeing that cost is equal to the modules themselves, which is like shocking.
Come to them. Yeah, please use the microphone.
The ballasts really are, if you're constructing on that capped area, okay, you can't penetrate the cap because that's engineering control.
So green zone.
The green zone.
Yeah, which is
so
not green.
If you stayed out of the green zone, then the ballast, that stuff would go away.
We do have a few ballasts also out in the just areas where Melody had indicated that potentially there might be some foundation, but the cap, just so we're clear, is chlorinated solvents. The rest of the site is petroleum. I mean, there's petroleum in there too, but there is a slurry wall built underground and then up. That is basically, if you drive by the site, you'll see it to the south. It's slightly elevated. That area, we had an incident where a vehicle drove over it. It was a problem. So can't crush that in any way. Everything's got to be very gentle on it. So.
All right. Follow-on question.
Yes.
Just looking at the RFQ, couple of notes on whether or not they did occur or will occur. And so that is identify possible state and federal funding opportunities? Was that like, that was the one federal grant and nothing else?
One thing I will say though is Matt forwarded me an example of a template for legislation that if council wants to direct administration would be able to draft and submit on your behalf for those House bills. But the legislative tone and tenor at the federal and state level has not been, has basically not been favorable. So they went through all of it. Actually, Dwayne, one of the principals in CEC, that's his wheelhouse. He actually is down at the State House on a very regular basis, speaking and lobbying for these types of legislation. So I would encourage council to have us write that letter and submit it on your behalf, you know, he knows everything that's happening, and there's he has encouragement, I think, for yes.
Okay.
And he was on every one of our calls and with us in that process. And,
last one. So if net metering did pass in the state, the easement issue would go away because then we can net meter and sell to anyone we want.
Potentially, the idea would be, well, virtual net metering is that you could sell to, for instance, the, like, and I think I mentioned Kent City Schools. They have multiple properties, lots of different locations. You could potentially structure a project depending on how the legislation is written. But the idea is you could sell that at, you know, retail rates to users like that with multiple.
So. And the city can consume as much of that because it's then.
Yeah, it could be to city properties as well. Yeah, I think they're currently, I believe, in draft, there is a limitation as to any one user can't take a certain amount. And I think that, and I'm sorry, I don't have this. Maybe I wrote it down. It might be like 30%. Yeah. Like one user can't take more than 30% in that situation. But yeah, again, that's all draft legislation that exists. But those types of options make your project it just have a lot more potential than having to be behind the meter. We're really this site, the only user is the wastewater treatment plant, which is fine. I mean, that's a good user, but that's the only one.
Thanks. So,
All right. Other questions? I do have a question. The letter to write a letter of support, would that be something that we could pass tonight if we wanted to bring that up and have that written? Okay. Well, we can come back to council for consideration on that, but I'd like to go to the audience. If the audience has any questions or concerns, it doesn't have to be a question. Seeing none, let's come back to council. Any motions, Chris?
Motion for Bridget, if you take the lead in writing a letter that we could get behind. I saw that Stowe recently passed a resolution in support of these community solar bills, so there's a model there.
Yeah.
So that's my motion.
I'll second.
Any comments?
Comment, if when drafting, we can also illustrate that we're trying to convert a brownfield within our community, right? That's a fundamental change. We can't really use the property, the site. This is a great use that we can. Okay.
Any other comments? All right. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Any against? All right. Motion passes.
I'll get that. It's emergency. Make sure I get it and look at it. Just real quick, too, I saw some of you writing notes. I do have the PowerPoint presentation, and Kathy has it, so Kathy can email that out to everyone so that you have those notes in front of you for reference purposes.
Thanks.
Right. Just if I could just close this with, just so that you understand, like, we wanted to bring you in on this, but it is still very early in sort of the due diligence process. But what we learned downtown, both the city and the university, actually with a lot of help from former Congressman Tim Ryan, we did a lot of prep planning work and environmental work, historic work, all the boxes that you got to check to get a project construction ready. Our goal is always, if we can find ways to afford it, and this time we have structure of partnership, we can maybe use some grant monies, we try to package it so it's ready to go to construction when there is like new legislation or there's just an opportunity. So yes, it's early. I hate to dampen spirits. I didn't mean to be like, yeah, we're not actually doing anything for a couple of years, but we want you to know it's something we're working on. It's promising. And fingers crossed, we'll have it's a great use, to your point, Benjamin. It's a great use for an otherwise pretty undevelopable property.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, thanks. Committee of the Whole, staff updates.
Dom, I feel like we should go. There's audience waiting. We appreciate you waiting. But this is in case you didn't notice, it's warm outside, it's summer. And part of our summer tradition, thanks to Dom and the help of her small team, is to recognize the best kind of kept and maintained and landscaped properties, the best of Kent. And we have a winner tonight. And Dom will present this. And again, we just want to continue that, something we started last year with the Yard of the Month program.
Yes, thank you. So each month, we've had a lot of applications, people nominating their neighbors, a lot more than last year. So it works. People saw it last year and people are excited for this. So you'll see this yard sign around town. And this is George and Julie Dietz. They live on Majors Lane. Their house is it's further up on their property, but they couldn't be here tonight. So we'll get them their little award. But then we have the Loeffler. Am I saying, what was it? Loeffler, the Loeffler family. Samantha and Aaron. They actually got four nominations from four different people. Some of the things that people were saying, that their home is a native flora magical. They have a free little library. You can see it. There's a bench up there. There's often children running through the yard, sitting, reading. Someone had said that they've taken a suburban front yard and turned it into a pollinator perennial dream. So we are very thankful for you guys. If you guys want to come up here, we'll take your picture with our council. That's okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Jim was going to be here tonight to reiterate something we already told you, but good news is worth celebrating twice. He claims it was allergies. I think he was overwhelmed with the heat probably, but the combination thereof, he texted Melanie and I and said, I just can't. He says it doesn't present well when I look like I'm tearing and crying and sneezing with good news. So I don't, Melanie, did you want to say anything in Jim's absence? Council is aware of it, but again, the community wouldn't necessarily be as aware of it. So we were trying to just take this chance to a little more money towards an important project.
I'm just going to apologize because I'm trying to read his handwriting and stuff and not necessarily, but he wanted to report that we recently received notification for construction, another $500,000 from ODOT's TID grant program for the North Manaway Street program. The total funding now that we're up to is $3.725 million, which is 60% of the needed $6.2 million. There are a few more opportunities out there waiting for us, and we'll be submitting in March $800,000 for an SRTS grant and some 629 funds that they're working on with the Portage Development Board, Team NEO, the Ohio Department of Development. The next steps is tonight you'll have before you the John Davy Arboretum Agreement. He just said JDA, so I'm just trying to go off of memory there tonight. We'll be looking for approval on that as well. In the future, things that will be coming is a construction and maintenance agreement with Davy, Kent City Schools, and the City of Kent. And then in the future, you'll be looking at receiving and accepting some easements that we'll need in order to complete that work. The schedule right now, everything is in place. Design is complete, and we are approved from the Federal Highway Commission. We are hoping by the end of November to be out with bidding contracts, and then hopefully construction will start in the spring of 2027. Yay. He did a great job, for sure. He's got good staff. Thank you.
Thanks, Melanie.
Yeah, Melanie and Jim both represent the city at a lot of the AMATs and different regional organizations, and I don't know if it's coincidence, but Melanie had like a black eye after one of those meetings, had to have surgery. I'm sort of joking, but it's a lot of hard work that goes into, as you imagine, everybody, every city wants more cuts, more pieces of the funding, right? And there is a system to it. And I'd say I'm grateful that both Melanie and Jim, I want to say worked the system to the Kent's advantage, but participate in the system to Kent's advantage consistently. So thank you for that. So lastly, it seems like we should talk about fiber optics, construction, installation, and it's a complicated topic. I mean, we have there's laws, there's limitations, and we can speak to a lot of that. I can tell you it's pretty much dominated our time for three straight working days, if not four. But again, most of that on our end is making sure, kind of doing our due diligence to both internally and with the contractors working in Kent, which for the record, the explosion was not one of the contractors working in Kent. Not that problems don't happen here too, they do. But so we just were going through our internal reviews, and Hope did her research, Bridget's doing hers. We've communicated with the companies. We do, as you know, have a temporary suspension of the right-of-way for boring, direction of boring. The basis of that is to do the due diligence to make sure all the appropriate safety measures and protocols are being followed. We have, as I said, kind of a sliver role in this. We have a little bit in the front, meaning they have to notify us where they're going to do the work, and we have certain requirements that Bridget can speak to in terms of what it is to get a permit, but we really can't deny a permit. We just have some influence on what goes into what they can do. Then during the process, there are certain requirements that they have to meet if they do hit stuff, which they do, underground construction. I will say this, it was obviously a tragic situation, and that gratefully nobody was injured. But anytime you dig underground, I mean, even Melanie, I'll tell you, our projects, especially in an older city where maps may not be what they are and records may not be what they are and construction may not have occurred exactly like the plans, and identifying where the pipes are is scientific adjacent, but it may not be scientific exact. And we've even hit pipes that, you know, unexpectedly with a backhoe. And I can tell you in my own yard, I noticed wires coming up out of the ground. I'm like, isn't that supposed to be 12 inches below the ground? It was like cable lines, you know, cable companies, they just put it where they want. So there's a lot, I guess, is the point. It makes it really hard to communicate this both to you guys in the community, what we're working on those things. We wanted tonight just to kind of give you the quick update where we're at, kind of what we think the next steps are. We have no legal basis, especially now as we've gone through this process. We really haven't found any holes in the Omni and the other company, Metro, in terms of their following the rules that we have in place. Is it a good time for a refresher? Absolutely. And is it a good time to, we've talked about, we've been polling other cities to say, is there something that maybe you guys have been doing that we could tap in or borrow and use in ours? And we've been doing those, having those conversations. maybe that's a good starting point, is to just let Hope give you a quick, I don't know, I say quick, I don't know if it can be quick. Why don't you just kind of talk a little bit about the legal picture, because so much of this is driven by what the state law allows, right, and doesn't allow.
Yes, and our current ordinance is called the, pardon me, it's chapter 937. It's called Use of Public Ways by Service Providers. And both Bridget and I, back in 2018, this council passed this ordinance because the state had been, that's when those small cells were knocking on everyone's doors, and the state made some changes to the state law requiring certain timelines and certain things that we had to do to make sure that cities weren't just sitting on applications and not doing it. So that was one of the main reasons we got an outside law firm to come in, take a look at the state law and help us redo the ordinance so we complied with state law, but it is also a very robust ordinance. It's really no different. When Bridget gets these, it's really no different than if someone wants to build a building, they have to submit detailed plans. You know, how are you going to reroute traffic? What are you going to do? When it's all done, you have to give us the site maps as to exactly where they are. And it is the application process. There are 3-4 pages, and I can send this ordinance to each of you. I'll do that either tonight or tomorrow morning if you'd like me to. There's also annual registration. And the part that made me go back and look at this was the revocation of consent, because I wanted to see exactly what we were, if we were permitted to revoke, and what were the reasons for that, what reasons we could. And there's only 8 of them. And some of them are like bankruptcy, failure to pay fees, a material violation of the chapter, if they misrepresented themselves on applications. But and the city manager, if we decided to revoke, he sends a notice out saying, we're going to revoke your license, here's the reason. Then we have to give them a 30-day period in which to cure the problem or to prove to us that it wasn't their problem at all. Like maybe maybe the gas company didn't go out and mark the lines or whatever. But they do absolutely have a right to be in our right of way. We can't just say, no, we've got too many. Move along. So I think, and I would like Bridget to go through the process as she goes through. I do believe at the end of this that once we get assurances from these companies that they are going to follow OSHA, and they have been, and they're going to call 911 when they're supposed to. If there is a hit on gas, especially, oh my gosh, I lost my train of thought.
Well, that's fine. You think for a second. No, I just did.
Bridget, yeah. I'll take it from here.
Well, I had a good point.
One thing too, as Hope mentioned, we did have to update that in 2018, but the ability for utilities to operate and install in right-of-way has been around for decades. You would not have gas or electric to your property. Spectrum wouldn't be there. You wouldn't have our old phone lines. How many of you have dug up a garden bed and found an old hard phone line? So it has been there. But what has happened is technology has added new inventions that are now included. So we had the small cell and they came. We were issuing small cell permits like you wouldn't believe. Now, most people wouldn't have recognized that because many were attached to poles. This fiber optic install is a utility as well. It's a newer technology. It's basically giving the hard connection that many want with everybody living on the internet and streaming. You need to have that. So it has been growing exponentially. The two companies that are working in our city right now are in 70, one is in 75 other communities, one is in 27. The difference, I think, this time is that they're very visible because you see them. But I will tell you, if you've ever seen a new subdivision built, you see the same stuff, right? You see them working. And I will tell you with 100% assurance that OOPS is always contacted. We contact OOPS. I suggest all of you also contact OOPS if you ever dig in your yard. The Ohio Utility, so 811. If you're digging, you do it. And even the hand digs, you should still call OOPS. That all being said, they had to provide us with a set of a plan that basically we went through in consultation with the city engineer to make sure we knew where our utilities were. The depth of these is much shallower than where your typical utilities are. But that being said, we are an old community. We have, Melanie can speak to this, we have sanitary water that are in the depths that they should be. We have gas lines. We have what are called as-builts, where the plan said it had to be X amount of deep, but the contractor is looking, I'm going to put it shallower, right, because they can get it done faster. It happens. We had 215 permits issued for these two companies, basically covering 175 miles of fiber install. And roughly, we've had, give or take, 30 strikes. Yes, that sounds like a lot, but 67% of those strikes were for mismarked or unmarked utilities. Several of them were hand digs. They all start with a hand dig. They create what's called a pothole. It's so that they can dig and really verify that depth of where it is it really where it is? And some of those hits were doing the pothole, basically doing an investigation. And we have those same things happen. What happened is a tragedy. But I will tell you, the companies themselves need to follow these rules because they are responsible, right? They have bonds out to us. They have to have insurance. Once they get a permit, a whole slew of other responsibilities happen. They have to keep us notified of what's going on, where they're at. We go back and we check for restoration, which, by the way, please, if anyone has restoration work in your ward that they're complaining about, let us know. Contact me or Hallie Stone, who's in my department. We will make sure we get out there. They are quick to respond. Ironically, they are in my yard in Franklin Township, and I watch them not seed and not tamp it down. And I just happened to have that supervisor in my phone. And I said, and he goes, well, we're just showing you we don't play favorites, which was kind of funny, I had to admit. But he had them come back and do it. So it happens. But overall, with the scope and scale of the number of permits that, by the way, I have been involved with daily, Hallie's been involved with daily, it has been fairly professional. They are very responsive. I get calls from them. If there's a hit in the evening, they call me. They text me. I know what's going on. They tell me, we called 911, fire is here. Or if it's a telecommunications, we hit an ATT, we've contacted them. So they've kept us in the loop. I wish all my contractors were this responsible. Contractors that install a lateral, they are required to call OOPS. They hit things as well. So this is for all the permits that we deal with. If you're working in the right of way, you're subject to the same requirements. Permit must be reviewed, approved, inspected, final. And we do it. We do it for all of them. So I want you to be assured that they are not just out there running roughshod, and that hits are not always the response. You know, hits happen. It's construction. We had hits in our downtown redevelopment on our own stuff. So it happens. It happens more often. And I think that's why when it happened in Twinsburg, it was a tragedy. But for me, I was like, oh, you know, it wasn't, because I knew that we were doing everything safe. I know in Twinsburg, they were doing things safe, but things happen. So I want to just dissuade any scent that they're running roughshod. They're not doing things through permit. They're not being inspected. All of that is happening. And again, I know these people. I've been out in the field with them. I've worked with them. If there's something wrong, they know I won't put up with it. And we correct it. We fix it. I don't. So,
can I tail on that just to say, I know you've got a question, Heidi. I'm sorry. But I don't want to lose another thought. The distinction here, I noticed, and I talked to Jack about comments he's heard from folks. there's a lot of confusion that somehow the city is like the project manager of this. We are not. Yep. We are stewards of a public process. And she elicited, or she listed the steps in the process. And we're sort of dictated what steps we're allowed to have. But those are the steps we have. And that's what Hope said. We have a pretty robust number of steps compared to a lot of places. But at the end of the day, and this is something that comes up so much, and I understand if you're not in the business, people assume, well, you're the engineer of record for this. Like, why did you let this happen? We are not. We are not. She's not really reviewing for technical performance or methods. She's reviewing for that simple checklist that she's allowed to check for. Where are you going to be working? And, you know, who's in charge? To her point, she's right. There is probably more layers of oversight than people might realize. But also on the flip side, we also don't control almost, we don't control it almost at all. And this is, and I remembered my point from earlier, this is private business.
Yes.
And we have limitations on how intrusive we can be on private business. Yes, it's in the public right of way. So yeah, we get to touch point on it, but it's still a limited touch point. And folks comment and all our conversations internally been like, so let's review where we're at. We have suspended the permits here in Kent for two companies that have nothing to do with the tragic incident. And what basis are we withholding those? What have they done wrong? She goes through her checklist. They haven't done anything wrong. Now, I get the public optics. That's what we're wrestling with. We want to make sure the community knows we've done the due diligence and we'll continue to do due diligence. But we also have to respect private business at some point. So that's where we're at now is like, okay, what we've essentially said is we want a second round of these conversations and we want you to publicly sign something, not publicly, but give us a signed notification that you are committed and upholding all the protocols.
And they both did today.
Yes. And so
I sent that list of, if everybody looked at that list, that's everything they're required to do.
And the third party in this too, that I don't, did you mention there? I was so busy thinking. Davy Tree, our hometown Davy Tree is the overseeing Omni's work.
Yes.
They were hired by Omni.
Yes.
So they have been, because I know this, because my neighbor, who's an executive over there, called me earlier this summer. I was like, hey, you need to speed up your markings. We got to go faster. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, oh, yeah, we were hired by Omni, and we're managing this. So sent them a letter, too, and said, you guys have always been a great corporate partner. We really need you to have a show an abundance of caution for all the safety protocols, all the procedures. And I personally kind of was a little more relieved when I heard Davey's involved because one, they're a professional, right? They're professional in what they do. And their hometown, this is their hometown. So obviously I don't think they want a tragedy anywhere, but never in their hometown. So I think look, we can't sit here and guarantee you there can't be, I'm looking at Jeff because he and I were having this conversation last Friday and I was the bearer of the news late in the afternoon. Jeff, they just nicked a gas line in your neighborhood, right on your street. Your street's closed, buddy. And he's like, are you kidding me? My dogs, or animals, I guess what he said. So it's going to happen. But again, there are procedures in place, just like,
yes,
unfortunately, there are tragic traffic accidents, but we don't stop driving, right? Like, I mean, I'm not trying to make light of the situation. I'm just trying to set the framework so that we can all be reasonable and logical as we move ahead.
And I think what you need to understand is I can pull a permit. And I pulled permits three times with these fiber companies because they didn't follow. One was they were working in an area that had not been, the permit hadn't been reviewed and finaled. One was they didn't set up a proper maintenance of traffic plan on a road that was required. And the other one was a repeat of not doing the MOT. I can pull the permit. I sit them down. I met with them. I said, listen, you cannot be blocking people's driveways. You can't block an intersection and crosswalk. And then they get the message. And all three of those permits, by the way, were for Omni Fiber. So Davey was the one I was meeting with and Omni. And that they were early. Those were back in the spring and summer of 2025. They've been here since the spring of 2025, by the way, these companies. So those were lessons learned. But I can't prohibit them from working. As Hope had highlighted, these are public utilities. First Energy and Dominion does the same things to us.
And they hope to be done by?
Omni is virtually done with all their permitting. The install, they're doing restoration. They'll be done within the next 6 weeks. And the other company said they'll be out by the end of summer. Omni Fiber.
Sorry,
Heidi. Yeah, well, I think it was in the late fall, winter. We did have one of those companies out in front of our house on the corner, and they were out there for what seemed like weeks. And I guess we couldn't figure out what they were doing. It was just such a weird mystery, the way they would stand on the street corners and the holes they would dig and, you know, all the markings. Nothing bad happened, and I think they did clean up after themselves. But it was, we didn't know anything about it. And so my question is, maybe as a result of the tragedy, people will learn something about this. But is there any kind of public notification?
Oh, yeah. That's required. Actually, if you look at that email that I sent today that they had assured they do door hangers or yard darts. And they also basically have, like, they're supposed to, if you stop and talk to them, they're supposed to be able to give you a card.
They did. They did talk. My husband went out and talked.
They do mailers. So Metronet did mailers and door hangers, and they did yard darts in some of the subdivisions. The Omni Fiber did the door hanger. I mean, I got a door hanger. It was on my mailbox. So they do them. I think, though, a lot of people tend to think it's like, you know, a pizza flyer or whatever, you know, it is a little difficult.
Yeah.
The process, if like somebody is curious as to what they're doing, you can call the community development department. We're happy to explain what they're doing. Uh-huh. But basically they're putting conduit and the fiber so that, and have points so that if you choose to get that fiber connection to your house, they can go straight up to your house from that location. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. I have a second question that's unrelated, but since we brought in Davy Tree, what impact does this have on the tree roots? We have a lot of mature trees.
Well, they're basically, the picture that was originally sent out on Friday was not the correct equipment. The circumference of what is being is de minimis. It's actually small. It's not going to go through, and they can't actually go through the root. So they go basically under, like around with mine, I had a huge tree. So they basically went under my drive and went a little lower to go under the tree, and then they come up. So it's maybe not a straight line, which is why it takes so long. Those holes you see them digging are peepholes. They're like, okay, well, we got a tree here. Can't go through that. So let's see what's going on here. But then they also are looking at where the utilities are and things like that. So the conduit, it's orange and blue coils, big fat ones. It's very flexible. So it's kind of like threading a needle. If that helps.
Yeah, we saw they were there for a long time, and that explains it.
Quite honestly, open cut would be worse. Somebody brought that up. I saw that on social media that, like, we should look at, you know, what about open cut? Do you imagine if they open cut every drive apron, every tree lawn, everything? The cost first would exponentially. They would be here for years. So that is absolutely not a good idea. So,
thank you,
Chris.
Just out of interest, I saw a sign on South Manaway on tree lawn said, "Don't dig here."
Yeah,
is that something that we're able to do? Is
people can put any kind of signs in their yard, well, as long as it's not profane.
That of course. But are we? But I assume the property owner has no yeah. right to the yeah. sort of the dirt below there.
Part of that, as I mentioned, they submit a site plan showing us like the area where they're going to trench. The one thing we do is we verify that they are within the right of way and not on private property. There was an instance in the Davy District neighborhood where a dig was started, and it was kind of wonky the way the sidewalk had been installed because it was an older neighborhood, and they thought they were in the right of way and they actually were on private property. It was caught by my field staff, and they was course corrected quickly before they got within, like, they weren't even like 2 feet down. So they refilled the hole. But yeah, if they're in the right of way, the city and private property owners cannot stop them. I will tell you though, there are, and I understand this because they care for the tree lawn. They care if you don't have a sidewalk, you care for that whole front lawn. There's an assumption that that is their property because they do have a responsibility for maintaining it, but it is right of way. But OmniFiber actually cut through, somebody had installed an underground sprinkler system in a tree lawn over in your neighborhood, Sarah. And she was very upset about it. Explained to her that, well, you shouldn't have been installing there anyways because that's city property. Instead, OmniFiber asked if it was okay if they repaired it. And I said yes. So they went in, they repaired it, and they had no obligation to do that because it really wasn't a public utility. So.
Jeff?
I thought we did a good job getting out ahead of this as far as messaging. We put out what you sent in the email about all the stipulations everybody has and get that out just so people know too and get that message out there.
I sent that email so we can have it copied and put on the website. Yep.
Perfect.
Yep. And both have sent me written assurances today, by the way. And I also got calls. I got calls from the field supervisors, and then I also got it from the representatives in charge of their overall projects here at Kent in writing.
Sarah?
I think that we could get them to do a letter of support saying that they're overseeing this project. I feel like people are skeptical because of what happened in Twinsburg, and maybe we could get them to say, you know, they're very...
They're only doing one of the fiber companies, though.
Not the other one.
Yes, correct. So that might be a little...
Other one.
They're self-managing. So they're not, and the reason they're using Davy is because OmniFiber has exponentially spread out. They do more communities. So then they hire a consultant in each community that's familiar with that community to manage it. Metronet self-manages everything. So they've done less miles than OmniFiber. So Davy isn't doing both. So they could do it only for their own company.
I did in closing my email to Greg and Sandy Reed at Davy, I said, it would be great. I think it would be a comfort to the community for you to affirm that everything, just to your point, that is being done, that can be done and is being done properly. So I've yet to hear back onto those, but I'm hopeful. They're usually pretty responsive.
Because I feel like if you get them on board, it will get the community a little bit more chill about, you know, the tragedy that happened, because they are respected in the community. If they're saying it's okay, it's safe, I feel like people will also feel like it's safe. If you can do it.
Yeah, we'll try.
Listening, Davy, we need your help.
Okay. Further questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And please, if anybody has questions or you see something that doesn't look right, call me. Call me, have them call me. I'm there. I take calls all the time.
Can I say one more thing? This is not members of the community should be calling the KPD for, correct?
It's no.
A waste of resources to call them.
They should be calling the Community Development Department, which basically does all the permitting and inspecting of private installation. Okay. Thank you.
I just want to say that this came up repeatedly in our internal conversations, that one of the great things about working in and living and working in a city of the size of Kent is you can get direct personal contact, not just with the field staff, but with the directors, city manager. Not that we want to like get swamped with every call possible, but I think people are underutilizing that resource. It's intentional. And I know one of the topics we're going to talk about next is noise. It's another one of those where we partner with the community. We can't be everywhere. So we need the community to let us know when there's a problem. That's what she's saying. Let me know. You know, I'd be happy to, and if I can't fix it, I can't fix it, but I can't fix what I don't know.
I took 2 tall weeds and grass complaints today. I dealt with an unsheltered storage, and you know, I will answer any of those questions. My staff, we take a lot of calls, so we answer the questions, but if you leave a message, we'll get back to you for sure. And if not, please let me know, because I'm very big on that with my staff. So
thank you, Bridget. Any more updates? That's it. Okay. Finance.
So Rhonda's up. We have two issues. The first is the consideration of the proposed 2027 county tax budget. You're up, Rhonda.
Thanks.
So as stated, in accordance with the Ohio Revised Code Section 5705, the tax budget for next year, 2027, has to be approved by council no later than July 15th. In past years, we've actually had to have a special council meeting after this one because the second council meeting of the month has always been past the 15th. So this time it's actually on the 15th. So we're going to pass that. If you approve it, it'll be passed next on the 15th. Couple things I wanted to make you aware of. I'm not sure if you've looked at all 44 pages of the tax budget, but a couple things to note is in Fund 106, which is Parks and Rec Fund, we had to include a transfer from the general fund in the amount of $250,000, and that's to help them maintain their expenditures for next year, keep them in the red, or out of the red, in the black.
I mean, that we've been forecasting that. I wish it had waited a little longer, and it might not. Keep in mind, the county tax budget is a preliminary estimate of resources and expenses. It's not your final operating budget. You get all the dig it in when the operating budget. But this is kind of an early warning notice, like, hey, that's coming true. What we said, their levies are not keeping pace. This is just basic. This isn't for new projects. Ferris wheel, splash pad, none of that. It's strictly keeping doing what we're doing, and they're going to need our. And I say that because this is the first time in Kent's history that we know of that we've had to supplement Parks and Rec.
Right.
And now we have talked about if the repurposed levy passes, we hope there'd be some latitude within that to start allocating. I was hoping to allocate it for the fun stuff, not just to keep the lights on, but it might be a blend of both. So FYI.
Right. And if you look in the tax budget, the 2026 column is still estimated of what we're going to spend this year. So it's not over yet. So we don't know exactly what we're going to start 2027 with. So we're estimating the beginning balances as well as the expenditures for next year. The other fund that we've talked about in the past is the Solid Waste Fund, Fund 205. That is also potentially going to be in the red next year if we don't minimize how much we're allocating or spending out of that. Or we've also anticipated talking to everybody about the fee for the Solid Waste Fund. We've talked about that for a number of years. We've included it in the capital budget for the past 2 years, showing that by 2027, if we don't increase the rates, it's going to be in bad shape.
Can you be a refresher on what that goes towards? The trash, the public trash collection at the trash cans around town, right? And some of the, what are some of the other things that goes into that budget, that line item?
Not the brush and brush chipping.
Right? Brush chipping. Okay. So some of the more popular city programs, that fee has not changed in ages. Now, I will say, I think I've given you an early heads up that we really needed a conversation probably about all our fee schedules because we haven't touched our fees in a while. Right. I know the chiefs have had conversations. Melanie's had a few with me, and Ron and I were like, okay, we're going to need a more serious look at our fees in general. And so we'll be bringing you that probably in advance of the budget.
Right. So that's all I had for the tax budget.
Anything from council? Questions? Anybody from the audience? Nobody's in the audience. Back to council. Do you need a motion from us, or are we going to do this, please?
Motion with emergency to pass.
Anybody have a motion?
I'll move to authorize with emergency.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Okay. The second item is the appropriation request number 5. That was a weird thing. These were discussed, part of these were discussed in our last meeting. And then we have a couple decreases. Yeah. If there's any questions on the memo?
Any questions from council? Yeah. What do you need from us, Rhonda?
Approve with an emergency as well.
I'll move to approve with emergency.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you,
Rhonda. Hey, health and public safety, Mr. Hope.
All right. We'll move to discussion of downtown noise impact on residential neighborhoods. I see
Do you have? I don't know that we per se have a planned presentation for you. I think we wanted to kind of react to the comments that started at previous meeting and carry that forward. And we're all here. It touches different departments, and we're happy to kind of have a answer and questions and stuff like that. I don't know how you prefer to roll this out, Jeff.
I was talking to Chris a little bit before. Like, I've talked to Kevin Kugel, who originally sent the last email, and I'm not to pick on the Zephyr, but most of the noise is coming from there, about, you know, giving them a heads up too, because I know the person that books the music about what we're doing. And also, I was at a concert in Cleveland at a venue that's indoor venue, 400 person venue, so fairly decent size, and took some decibel readings in there. So I'll go to the Zephyr at some point and compare, but they know that they're loud. And then, you know, they aren't going to be surprised if we try to make some changes. I think some changes are going to be needed to do a balance between the neighborhoods and downtown. And I also asked Mr. Kugel, I called him today, and I know there's a musician that's going to be performing from 7 to 9 every Thursday in July that's acoustic guitar with an amplifier singing. So I said, hey, can you walk out your front door? And that's going to be on the Zephyr patio. And give me an idea of what that sounds like in your neighborhood. And so I can give Zephyr an idea of, like, hey, this is carrying this way, this is carrying that way. I looked at some different noise ordinances about, so I think it's a matter of striking a balance for everybody. I don't think it's unreasonable after looking at some different cities to change our hours that we have right now. And this is probably going to have to be an evolving process over a few different changes until we get it figured out. And I'm sure, Chief, that you need some tools. So if people need to go out and enforce this, they have some hard, fast rules that they can just go and say, this isn't allowed here, or this is too loud here. So whatever we can do to make it easy for everybody.
I want to react to that, Melissa.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin sent a letter, but a lot of people have contacted me because it's a particular issue in Ward 1 with the sound, the way the sound, which I'm sure Ben knows as well, comes up in a particular odd way up into the ward area where we are. So Main Street, Pioneer, and that neighborhood all over there. The sound it resonates in a really close fashion. And you know, we have a lot of people who live in our wards that get up really early, or they work really late. We have doctors and nurses and school teachers and people who, mm-hmm. You know, work on roads early in the morning, and kids who have to get to school who maybe, you know, are impacted by that. And at the same time, we are a college town and we are a music town, and we need to find a balance, as Jeff was saying, between those two things. And I think it's really important that we have some clarity here for Chief and for anybody, but also for our venues, our venue managers and owners. They need to know that we are all on the same page and that it's pretty clear. I think in particular, the music that plays outdoors in the summer, in particular, there's something in maybe about the warm air that also makes it carry. It's really loud. It can be really loud. And if it's 11 o'clock on a school night and it's really loud, I don't know that that's really considering both sides of who we need to think about in our community, right? People who have to get up or go to bed early, and young children. So that's really, I want to find out, you know, are there repeat offenders? Have we had issues with people who are not following the guidelines? So maybe that's something you can give us, Chief. That from my perspective, that would be helpful.
I can speak some on that. So I've done the research. I looked back. So I looked primarily at the warmer months of the year. I went back to April 1st and looked at our noise complaints downtown. And this is kind of a conversation I think some of you have been involved in some regards. We don't get a lot of noise complaints, and that's part of the issue. So we've had not one noise complaint about the Zephyr or from that neighborhood that you're speaking of about this noise to the police department. Not one. Out of the 7 noise complaints we've had downtown, 4 of them were for Barfly, and they were made from people who live at the Landmark, which is right next door. We've had 2 complaints in Dan Smith Park and 1 complaint at the Brew House. So that's part of this. One of the things I would encourage all of you is when you hear these complaints from residents, it's not to say that we aren't monitoring this as well, because obviously we know it's an issue. But if you hear these complaints from residents, please ask them to call us when it's going on, it's going to be a lot easier for us to enforce. I think the next thing that's kind of interesting in this conversation is in talking to our night shift patrol lieutenant. When I told him about this complaint, he was kind of surprised when it was that it was specific to the Zephyr, because his position on that is the Zephyr is generally speaking not like up there in terms of noise for some of the downtown establishments. They're not as loud as some of the others. So I don't know if it's just the way sound travels through there or how that, you know, there's obviously something there that's causing that sound to travel the way that it does. Above and beyond that, we have, we sent our night shift officers out there to speak with the staff at the Zephyr, advise them of the complaint, educate them on the noise ordinance. And our approach to this, we don't want to go out there with a heavy hand and take a punitive approach right off the bat on this. So we've talked to them. We've told them that if and when these complaints do come in, we'll come out here. We'll touch base with you. We'll work with you to quiet it down. Now, if we have to continue to respond to continuing complaints, that's a different story. We may have to take enforcement action if we get to that point. So we've worked with them on that, trying to just be kind of a partner to the business side of this as well, but also a partner to the community and saying, there's an issue with this noise. We need to be that kind of liaison between these two different kind of almost competing interests to say, everybody needs to kind of play well in the sandbox together.
That is very curious, and I appreciate hearing that. I think they're just complaining to me. And I have told them that we do have ordinances in place, and if while it's happening it's loud, please call the police department. But maybe I'm the easier person to reach, I'm not really sure. So I don't even know what to think about it. So
if there is something, I mean, I've given this, we've talked about this because I spent a fair amount of time with Jeff, and it was he echoed to be a pun, but he echoed the same thing you said. Literally, it amplifies as it goes up the hill. He's speculating. I wouldn't be shocked if it was decibel wise louder at the top of the hill than it was at the bottom of the hill. So clearly, it's kind of like similar to the Land O' Lakes, where sound travels in weird ways. And we need to know, though. Like, that's the thing. Like, when council discussed this last time, one thing I can tell you right away, staff originally recommended 10 o'clock quiet time for the week nights. There was a room full of musicians and council was here. And I think there was one, maybe two people that spoke concerned about the noise. So I think in the end of the day, they hung their hat on 11, but we could just keep in mind, we suggested 10, you could certainly roll that back. I'm not sure. That's part of it, but I also think that's this amplification thing. And what I need to say there is, we spent a lot of time with council talking about the complications with trying to set decibel levels. Like, it actually ends up being more complicated and probably harder to enforce. And there's technology and calibration. So what we all landed on was, we're going to use the good judgment of the police. But if the police aren't being told, they can't use their judgment. And so it goes back to what I said earlier. We're a small city. Use your staff. And he may come to me and say, you're killing me with these things. But that's a problem. We'll deal. Right now, the problem is the reverse. We're not hearing it to be able to intervene on the community's behalf or your behalf.
I know that the spot where it gets, because I lived right behind where Jerry lived, so in my window face downtown. So I know about where that peak is, where it hits. And I know that after Pride a few weeks ago, I walked from downtown to a friend's house that lives on Lowell, right across from Davie. And there was a point where I don't hear any noise from downtown. And then as I start to climb up that hill on Park, all the noise comes back. So there is a very specific pocket. So maybe the night shift guys, just out of pure, like, just okay, yeah, maybe this is a little bit different, could like drive by the Zephyr, okay, there's bands playing outside and it doesn't really sound that bad, but then go drive up to the, I guess it'd be like the 500 block of Pioneer and Park about there, and see like if they notice it, like, oh yeah, it is really resonating up here, just so they have a point of reference for everybody. But I don't know if there's one hard fast solution. I feel like they're just in a tunnel of brick walls that bounces off those. I think if they were facing the neighborhood directly, it would probably actually be quieter in the neighborhood.
Yeah, just to piggyback on what you said, Jeff, I mean, maybe there's a technical solution to it, like maybe some kind of sound panel or something that can absorb. But, you know, we have to kind of really understand what the parameters are in order to see and, you know, maybe do some research and find out what has been done by others in these kinds of situations. And then, of course, the funding issue. But, you know, I mean, who are the stakeholders? And what role does the city play in, you know, mitigating the sound? I say that if it is truly a disturbance for a kind of a relatively small group of people, it's a problem. I mean, I'm not going to bring up fireworks that happen every night, but it's, you know, we hear downtown too, and I'm six blocks away, but we don't hear it to the obnoxious level. You know, it's not like it's resonating in our house. It's just sort of a din, you know, so there is a kind of a balance, you know. Yeah, you can sort of shut out the din, but if it's really coming at you, these are sound waves that are unhealthy for people. And, you know, that's something we might want to make an effort to explore. What is the problem? Who's being affected? What's the parameter of that line? And then what could be possibly done?
Oh, sorry. I'm
go ahead.
Just to add, they're also coming to me complaining because we're in the neighborhood, and just the reality of summer nights is you want to have your windows open, but in our neighborhood, that's not an option because it is so loud. And it's exclusively coming from the Zephyr area because it is that one singular sound. It's not a blur of sounds. It's the singular sound coming from, unfortunately, that venue. So I'm wondering if we can go to the business and be like, look, this is an issue. Look, I don't want to tell any business to like curtail their hours or the enjoyment of our community in that space, but it is a hindrance to our community. And so maybe the business can look into that, and maybe there's an innovative sound dampering thing that they can put on their large brick walls or something like that, that actually is a very quick fix. And then it doesn't have to curtail the hours, because I don't see another solution. If we're not going decibels, then it will have to be hours, because it's children falling asleep at night. It's the early workers. I feel like we have to address it. Maybe the business owner can address this on their own.
So I would say, like, it is a shame that it is pretty unique to one business, but I think it just sets itself up for that. And I'm sure there's experts that could speak to it, but I kind of equate it to like when we talked about the days of the year that we're going to have Franklin closed. Like, that is an advantage to some businesses, and they have to invest to take advantage of that, whether that's through extra staffing or advertising or extra tables or whatever they want to do. So the Zephyr has the advantage of, we have this big patio and we can bring in bands and we can bring in people off of it. And that's good, and we want that. But I think that it's okay to put a little bit of burden on them to say, okay, we want you to do this, but you need to invest in your property in a way to where, like, it doesn't impact up, you know, whether that's a quarter mile away. Because I want them to keep doing what they're doing, but they need to assess what can be done. And I think I'm sure people that get paid well above my pay grade know how to instantly fix that. And there have been venues I've been to that are inside and outside use, and they have very engineered systems to contain the sound as best as possible. There's one in downtown Canton that had bands play outside from hour X until maybe like 9 p.m. I think it was. And then after 9 p.m. it shifted inside. And I know that's not something that can happen overnight. And we have a whole summer, hopefully, where people are down there supporting our businesses and supporting this effort. So maybe we look at in the time change for now, and then try to work with them to say, hey, can you guys, like, I don't think this should be on our dime. It's their business. They're investing in it. They want to do this as a business model. Can you guys look into what we can do to mitigate this sound? Yeah, I think And I mean, we could change the times today, and in a month from now, we look and realize, okay, maybe we did go an hour this way or a half hour that way. And I don't think it needs to be hard and fast. I mean, this is a discussion. The problem's not going to solve itself overnight. So this discussion can keep happening. And if it happens and we get it fixed by when we get it fixed, as long as I think we just need to keep working on it.
Go ahead. Yeah, I like it. I was going to say you kind of need a carrot and you kind of need a stick. I'm not sure what the carrot is other than the goodwill of the community. The stick might be that, hey, for the time being, until we get this work figured out, until you get this figured out, we're willing to be partners to a certain extent. But, you know, have you considered hiring an acoustic expert? You know, we do have Woodsies in town. Maybe they have some ideas as to what kind of sound panels could be put up. You know, but I do like the idea of shifting the time now, because if nothing changes, there's no incentive for anything else to change. I like the idea of saying we really do appreciate a vibrant downtown. But this, yes, you know, we do need to safeguard the health of our population. And it is unhealthy to keep people up late, let alone being exposed to constant noise. So I guess my question, my comment would be to, how do we go about doing this? Who would be our representative to this business? Because it seems to be narrowed down to one particular business.
Eric Helmstetter, the Economic Development Director. So, and just basically say that, you know, council, if you guys choose, is changing the time because of this, and we really need you to figure this out, because it could be sound panels. Honestly, when I walk by there, I used to bartend and they used to have open mic. That's an old amp. You know what I mean? Maybe it's just equipment. You know what I mean? It could just be equipment that's can't be calibrated right. I think they should go talk to Paul Brayden, you know?
Yes.
He does shows all over the country and just say that it's a problem and, you know, it needs figured out. But I can have Eric do that, that conversation with them, depending on what council chooses to do with regards to the messaging.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Bridget. So the Zephyr has their own sound system That's what they're using? Yeah. So it's not individual musicians?
Well, there are, when you go to the gazebo, they bring their own equipment. But I think in the Zephyr, it's this. Part of that. Do they have, is it their own?
They have their own PA system. I mean, the bands are bringing in amplifiers, drum sets, and all that. I believe they're miking a lot of that equipment now and putting it through a sound system.
Okay.
Do you know why they need to put it through a sound system if they're using like an amp and everything? That's kind of like a little bit overkill for that size of that patio.
I'm old. We used to do it with just a PA for the vocals only and have our amps that were probably turned up way too loud anyhow. But no, I mean, they wanted to sound good. They wanted to mix through and sound good. And they do a good job of that. I think it's just like they have this like weird geographic anomaly where they're at. And then the infrastructure around it makes them a bit of the target. But I mean, I think we need to universally inform everybody downtown. Like, this is the standard. So if somebody else wants to do a live performance, you know, whatever the case may be, it needs to be universal. I hate to just pick on them because they're, you know, I've been there and friends of mine, but that is where the generation of the noise does come from. But in their defense also, like somebody I know from there did record a video like well after midnight of people that just set up in the gazebo on their own outside of a venue and started playing. So that's a different issue that would need to be addressed. So like, and if they did get a call at midnight for that, like I'm sure the officers would be able to very quickly discern where the noise is coming from. And we could say, oh, it's actually this. So.
Yeah, I do want to say that when we make a law or change a law, we're doing it for everybody. So, yeah, I know. But I mean, we would have to get word out to everybody that the quiet time has changed and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the other businesses might say, we're not a problem, but, you know, now we have to, now we have to abide by this, because I think it would be a really good idea to first talk to the business, have Eric talk to the business, and then say, this is what council is thinking about doing. So delay that, just would people be okay with the delay of changing the quiet times, or is that feel like that has to happen right away?
So if we decided to do that and we went and talked to the businesses even tomorrow, we don't come back for another month. And then after that, we vote on it 2 weeks later. So you're talking about six more weeks. So you're putting us in the middle of August and you're putting us, you know, three quarters of the way through the outdoor season. So I don't think it would be unreasonable because we're acting in the best interest of the citizens and we're treating businesses fairly to change the hours and then continue this conversation and say, hey guys, we're changing these hours because of X, Y, and Z. Can you help us out and like try to come up with a solution for this? And just, you know, I think we kind of maybe like implement that at the after the holiday weekend. And when we have live music for events downtown, that is capped at 10 o'clock, I think. If they're out on Hometown Bank Plaza or for Oktoberfest, whatever the case may be, we cap that at 10. Tom, do you know what the, do we cap like the outdoor music for the different festivals downtown at 10? Are you sure?
That's how I remember. Generally speaking, it's over by 10. I don't know that there's a hard cap on it because the ordinance says what the ordinance says, right?
Right.
I mean, on the weekends, it's still midnight. On the weeknights, it's still 11.
Okay.
So I don't know that there's a hard cap. I mean, maybe the events themselves are saying we're not going to run past 10. Yeah. But generally speaking, I don't think there's another law that caps it.
Is it? Yeah. So maybe it's just whoever's putting on the, whether it's Main Street Fans or Chamber, they just have like an internal.
Can we do something? Does it make sense maybe to have two different times, outdoor music or festival or events that's over by 10? Indoor music, 11, we could keep it to 11.
Well, I think indoor, it's a lot easier for them to mitigate it. So I think then at that point.
Well, because the biggest problem is the outdoor music.
As the outdoor.
Specifically, and we're picking on the Zephyr, but. I really think it's probably a technical acoustic issue that we just need to figure out how to get through.
Yeah, I agree. I'd be fine with that until we can come back with a better solution.
Yeah.
To 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
Every day, all days. And then.
And not change the time for.
Just leave it at 10 o'clock for all 7 days.
You mean for outdoor music?
For outdoor music.
Yeah.
I don't think we address indoor separately at this point. And then say, hey, let's work on some better solutions to figure out so you can be out there later if you want to be out there later. Or do we, the other option is saying like, you can only have outdoor music on the weekends or permitted or on weekends and holidays and permitted otherwise. Like, I don't know if that's a viable solution or not. Like, I don't, that's a big cash cow for them is having people on their patio. So you don't want to cut their legs off on it.
Of course not.
Right.
Yeah, of course not. But also the ordinance as it sits right now is that the music cannot go beyond the boundary of your business.
Right.
So even if they were indoors and it was 11 o'clock and it was too loud and it was coming out into the streets, we already have the guidelines in there. I think really it's just the outdoor music that's the issue. And if we have festivals and they're capped already at 10, let's just be really consistent about outdoor music.
Right. And
until we can, I mean, because we can always revisit this.
Right. I was just in the city of Cleveland and they, I know, I think it's House of Blues, Grog Shop, a lot of it, like they all I think have, I don't know if it's weeknight or I think they have an 11 o'clock cap on a lot of concerts in Cleveland. I'm fairly certain. I'm not 100% certain. I also go to No Class, which is in Lakewood, which is in a different city. I don't know what they're indoor, and that's all indoor, but I know I've been there well past 11. So I'm fairly certain the city of Cleveland is 11, but don't quote me on it.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say that you can come up. Outdoor, indoor might be a problem when we have businesses that have like garage doors. They're open. The band's in there, but it's like blaring out and disturbing people. So that might be a line of discretion for the police or.
I would agree. And that's, I walked over to Bridget when you were talking about the indoor versus outdoor thing. I think the focus needs to be on noise level and level of disturbance. I guess to me and to the community, does it matter if they're inside or outside if the noise level is so loud that it's disturbing other people? Mm-hmm. It also kind of makes it a little bit more difficult for us because if you restrict it to only outdoor music and another establishment that's completely indoor is blaring their music just as loud as the outdoor music was, why are we taking action against this outdoor music but not this venue that's indoor? I think it starts to to kind of feel a little bit more like a fairness issue, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, if we changed it so that outdoor music ended earlier, is that clear? I mean, does that help you clarify the difference?
I do think that if you have something that says outdoor music has to be done by X time, it gives us a little more teeth. I don't know, and hope
you
maybe.
You guys, the ordinance already delineates that it's only outdoor outdoor music. So
I think that's all we should address today.
Yeah, I think we should just.
That gets us on the right path.
Okay. Because the Kent State Hotel is in the DORA, and we're going to tell someone that has a wedding that they got to turn the DJ music off at 10, but they get the place until 12. I don't think that's a good idea.
And that's sort of what I was getting at. Like, if you have a wedding at the Kent State Hotel contained inside, that music's not disturbing everybody in the neighborhood. So, you know, that's why I think the focus should really be on that level of disturbance.
And that, I would have a question I would ask Eric, but she was here, but talking about moving from 12 to 10.
That, 12 on the weekend.
Right, on the weekends.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what Melissa was saying is a flat 10. Is that going to be too dramatic of a change going 2 hours back on weekends?
Well, I don't think we're stopping them. We're using that as a cap to evaluate where we're at and go from there to come back again with, hey, what did you figure out just to make this so it just stays here? Like, there's nothing preventing them still at that point from saying, okay, first three bands you play outside from 7 to 10, bands 4 and 5 get to set up inside and play until midnight. As long as, like, they can stay fairly contained in there. And it's because it's on call, like, they're only going to respond if they get a call. We haven't got calls on inside music. So I think it gives us a chance to evaluate the situation and see what we can do about it.
Can I just want to clarify based on what you just said. I think if we have a hard, fast law on the books that say outdoor bands must be done by 10 and an officer sees an outdoor band after 10, that changes the conversation a little bit. If we're not getting calls, we don't know that people are disturbed.
Right.
It's not to say that if something's that overboard in terms of noise level, they wouldn't stop and address it anyway. But when you have a law on the books that say outdoor bands are done at 10, that's very visible, right?
Right.
The officers see an outdoor band. It's after 10 o'clock. It's time to tell them that they're done.
Yeah.
So I think that there is a visibility difference here. And you know, you're taking away that ambiguity of, is this disturbing to people?
I think
because the band's visible, the band's not allowed to be playing after this time.
Right. We don't want it to be ambiguous. We want it to be, here's the
rule. From a police perspective, it does. It makes it more clear for us.
Right.
It makes it easier to see and take action in a moment because we're no longer guessing if people are disturbed.
And in that instance, are you going up to the band or are you going up to the bar manager?
It's going to be the management of the establishment to say, hey. Mm-hmm. And I still feel strongly that, especially with this being something new, do I think that on first offense night one, we need to say, hey, your band's playing at 10:05. Here's your site. No, I don't think that that's a reasonable approach. I think we approach the management of the establishment and say, hey, band needs to be done by 10. It's after 10. It needs to go inside now. They can no longer play outside. And as long as we get their cooperation and it stops, we're good with that.
Any other comments?
But yeah, where's the leverage, like, for getting it back to the Zephyr issue? Where's the leverage for that? And say, where's the leverage for, say, we'll just call it Barfly closing their garage door so that the sound, even with an indoor band, doesn't go out to the whole entire residential area around it, because I do get complaints from that area too. This is really hard. And what about busking? You know, somebody who's just playing their guitar, you know, at, you know, 10:15, is it incumbent upon the police to stop that? I guess it would be good if we did this to call it a
much, you know, this we're doing this as in a short term kind of way, to see, you know, how it goes, like, instead of we're, you know, to see what comes up, what happens, and then we can come back and talk about maybe the long term, more long term approach. Does that make sense? So we can see really how things work out, and then say they get some, say some problems are solved. Do we make shifts to this? I mean, go ahead.
The rules basically been suspended this whole time, so I'm gonna offer one comment, which is that it feels like from 12 to 11 feels more incremental and reasonable. 12 to 10 feels pretty drastic. These bars may already have groups lined up to begin at 10. And so they may have to cancel them altogether. My thought is, we're still pretty unsure about this. And I think from 12 to 11, it tells our citizens that we're doing something about this. We are studying the issue, we're talking to Zephyr, without having to go full 2 hours back. That feels a little drastic.
Put that on weeknights for 11 too, or roll that to 10? Because we have it separate.
I would support rolling back 1 hour
each Monday through, or Sunday through Thursday,
and then Friday,
Saturday. Saturday you could just.
Sarah.
So actually, I didn't think about that. They might already have their entire summer bands. I think we're gonna have to talk with the downtown businesses. Mm-hmm. I don't think that this is gonna be something we can
do now
because mm-hmm. while we do want to address the citizens' concerns, what if those businesses already have their bookings, say even through mm-hmm. August? You are right now, we're gonna have to cancel that.
Yeah, I mean,
the more we talk about this, the bigger the mud hole gets.
Yes, rains.
That's mm-hmm. always
if they can't predict rain. These businesses aren't mm-hmm. bound to only open at 7 or 6. They could say, okay, hey, we got to start the show a half hour earlier, because there's contingencies that are out of their control already.
And I was going to suggest the incremental approach that you said, to 10 on the weekdays and 11 on the weekends. And we're not saying no to shows, we're just saying no to loud shows. That's what we're really fundamentally saying here. So it's, and there are other circumstances, and incremental also gives us the leeway. We could go to 10 on the weekends. That might be something that is still necessary. We leave that open. Let's see how the businesses respond to this and the community's concern about this important issue.
Can I jump in on that too? Keep in mind, just because we say until 10, till 11, if it's rattling the china in your house at 8, call the police.
Yeah.
And they can go in and say down. So it's not like it's a free for all until 10 or till 11. It's just a matter we need to know. And we'll try to, obviously, he's already talked to the shift commanders, but he will continue to say, staff permitting, we need to pay attention to this, but it never hurts to get your neighbors. Or if you get the call, just call us. Say, I got free calls. So it's not a free for all. It's not a free pass until 10.
I make a motion.
Yeah, let's get a motion.
I'd like to motion that we adjust the hours for the noise ordinance for live outdoor music, 11 o'clock on Friday and Saturday, and 10 o'clock on Sunday through Thursday.
Great. Any final comments?
Nope.
Great. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Great. Passes.
Great.
Chief Samples.
Good evening. So we recently had a deadline to submit for 3 federal grants at the fire department. So I'll start with the first one, which is the SAFER grant. Many of you that were on council last year will remember we applied for the SAFER grant, which is really meant to be a catalyst for communities to bring on additional staffing that they haven't had in the past. And the federal government with this grant absorbs a lot of, but not all of the funding in the first 3 years. You'll see in your packet, the breakdown is the SAFER grant funds 75% of the cost of a firefighter's salary and benefits package in years one and two. City pays the other 25%. And then they're easing you into the city's budget in year three. They kind of flip-flop a bit, where the grant pays for 35%, and then the city absorbs 65% of those costs. I know we have other things, irons in the fire here we're talking about with firefighter staffing, but this would truly be a catalyst for the fire department to bring that staffing on. We did submit the application because it was time sensitive, due on the 22nd. What I'm asking tonight is for council's authorization, should we be awarded that, to accept it and have budget and finance allocate those funds for the hiring of three firefighter paramedic positions with emergency.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Have a motion.
I'll move to authorize with emergency.
Yes.
Great. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you very much. Okay, grant number two is called the Fire Prevention and Safety, or FPNS grant. It is through FEMA as well. I'm working directly with our fire prevention officers, which do public safety in the community, elderly, children, etc. And one of the things we identified is that cooking fires is one of the major causes of fires in the country. And so they found a safety prop that folds out and essentially becomes a kitchen countertop and a stovetop and oven. And so they can take this. It has portability. This is what we decided is something we don't currently have in our repertoire. So we thought it would be a good source of a grant. This grant is about $9,000 for that grant. It was due on the 22nd of June. We applied for that, and our portion is just a $447 small match on that. So same as before, I'm asking for authorization on this grant, should we get it, to accept it and allocate the funds for this purchase with emergency.
Thank you.
I love this, and I think that when you get it, I think that you should take this to the high school and do this kitchen for children that just completed this cooking class that my daughter was in, because her stories were terrifying. And I think that, this kitchen, because our young people need to learn this kind of safety. So I 100% support it. If you'll take it to we'll take it to all of them.
Well, it'll be available in the community to take everywhere. Yeah.
I really think our young people should use this or watch this demonstration, because we have this class at the high school, and I need to do it.
On a motion?
Motion. Emergency.
Great. Second by Heidi. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Last one.
Okay, thank you. And the final one is called the Assistance to Firefighter Grant through FEMA. This one is very pertinent to us in that our turnout gear at the fire department has a lifespan. And that lifespan is 10 years. That's a kind of a consensus standard. 10 years ago, we got a grant to buy 10 sets of gear. And a year later, we did another grant and got 10 more sets. The life cycle on that is expiring, which is going to be a big bill for me to replace some of this gear. So in trying to address that first round this year, we put in an AFG grant on June 22nd. That was for $51,340 for 10 sets of firefighter gear. We do have a 10% match, which ends up being about $4,600. So with that being said, I'm asking for council's authorization on this grant to accept it if awarded, and fund that money or have budget and finance put that AFG grant money in so we can purchase the turnout gear with emergency.
Thanks. Questions or comments? Motion?
Move to authorize.
Motion from Melissa. Is there a second?
Second.
Second from Jeff. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Streets and Sidewalk. Mr. Tipton?
Streets and Sidewalks. All right. Jim is coming up to the podium. Yes. Okay. And the first up is OPWC applications.
Yes, thank you. We are here for you tonight in request of approval for the ability to go and submit to OPWC for some grants and some no interest loans. The two projects before you tonight, again, we spoke a little bit earlier, State Route 59, and we are requesting that council's approval to submit funding applications for this project. It would be an $850,000 grant with a $150,000 10-year no interest loan. Probable cost for the project right now is $8.2 million. Currently, $6.2 million is obtained in outside funding. The required local share will be split between Kent, PARTA, ODOT, and Franklin Township. The earliest outside funding would be available of 7-1 of next year, and as we said earlier, the construction would be able to begin late 27, early 2028. Part of this project, as you had the opportunity to look, is that we would be reducing lane widths. We would have a continuous sidewalk on the north side, continuous shared use paths on the south side, and accessible bus stops. This would also include resurfacing and replacing the traffic signals. We respectfully request approval to apply for this OPWC grant and loan with the emergency. Our second item is our SCADA. For our water reclamation facility. Those that had an opportunity to visit got to see several of the things. This is part of what we're doing to implement in that. This is a request for a $250,000 grant and $150,000 10-year no interest loan. This would be the first phase of a multi-phase project. And we are currently in the process of preparing those designs and those specifications for construction in 2028. So we, again, would ask for the approval of the SCADA system program for the water reclamation facility replacement to be submitted to the OPWC, again, with emergency.
Okay, thank you. Any comments on either one? Or questions? And I think we have to move each individually, yes?
We have to move each individually? So can we just say we move to approve... is it receiving the grants or it's applying
both,
for
both applying and then the applying ability to receive and accept when we receive them?
Yes, and accepting the two OPWC
Ohio Public Works
funding Commission. Opportunities.
Sorry,
yeah, the two at both at once. I can say that for the motion. Okay,
great.
All right, so let's, yeah, so move to authorize and accept. With emergency.
Second.
Yeah, I do want to say something.
Further comment?
Yeah, I do. I want to say that it would be great at some future point to get another update on the State Route 59, which takes us out into Franklin Township. It's such an important project. You know, if anybody drives that way, you sometimes see people running across five lanes of highway, basically, and sidewalks come and go, and it's buses have difficulty, and it's really an innovative project with our partner Franklin Township, and PARTA, I think, is involved in that to some extent. But it's like an extension of our Main Street project that then extends out into an area where we do have residents and people that attend Kent State, and you know, it's and businesses that can contribute to our JED. So it's important in a lot of ways. And of course, the SCADA is important too.
Any further comment? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. Thank you, Molly.
Great. Do the next step.
Is there another one?
This is to, is there not another one on there for the Davy Tree Arboretum?
Davy Tree Arboretum, joint use agreement. No. Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Again, we are before you tonight, and I'd like to note that this is both a collaborative effort between our engineering division, the service division, as well as the Parks and Recreation Department. And then, of course, the great job that Jim does to bridge that availability with our local companies. But what you have before you is attached and you received is the John Davy Arboretum, the JDA Joint Use Agreement. What this will allow is for us to construct a new sidewalk on North Manaway Street to connect the JDA cabin and public restroom to the new SEED campus. And it would permit visitors to the GDA to use the SEED campus Arboretum parking lot. This would permit visitors to be able to go back and forth between both the public property as well as the SEED campus. The sidewalks that will be needed in order to have this project completed, again, will be a part of the North Manaway Improvement Plan. We are respectfully before you asking approval to this agreement with the emergency clause.
Any questions or comments from council?
It is a 10-year, no financial requirement from either entity, but a term of 10 years.
And then if the sidewalks need to be repaired and...
I'm assuming that it is a shared agreement in here, but I'll be honest, I did not have an opportunity to review this as I just got found out that I was presenting this tonight at 5. So, but I have to assume Jim takes care of all of that in here, so I have to believe that there's probably a 50-50 sharing.
It's in there. The sidewalk, but it talks about the parking lot, who's responsible, and the public restroom.
Any further questions or comments? Not hearing any. Anybody want to move?
Move to authorize with emergency.
I'll second.
Seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Says thank you.
Jim thanks you immensely.
Yes.
All right. Now I'd like to call an executive session to consider the appointment, employment, dismissal, discipline, promotion, demotion, or compensation of a public employee or official.
Second.
Second by Chris. Roll, please.
Ms. Selka? Mr. Clapper?
Yes.
Mr. Drager?
Yes.
Mr. Hook?
Yes.
Ms. Schaefer-Bish?
Yes.
Mr. Tipton?
Yes.
Mr. Turner? Ms. Wallach? Ms. Wesley?
Yes. Okay. This should be real quick.